This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to begin our show with a discussion with Peter Bick. He's a filmmaker and he also teaches at Arizona State University. And we're going to talk about his project, Carbon Cowboys. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Well, Doug, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, let's talk a bit about yourself before we get into the specifics of this project you've been working on. How did you come to this place in your life, and how would you describe this place?
Well, this place being celebrating farmers who are working with nature, I came to it from the perspective of climate change. I made a movie in 2011 called Carbon Nation, and that film's about solutions to climate change. And in that film and in that research, I learned about farmers who were focusing on nature, focusing on their soils, and were drawing down enormous amounts of carbon from the atmosphere, storing it in their soils, where it is basically the currency for all good things to happen. The microbes love the carbon, the plants love the carbon, and the animals that feed on the plants love those plants to be nutrient dense. And so I started making a film called Soil Carbon Cowboys back in 2013, and that introduced me to Alan Williams and Gabe Brown and Neil Dennis up in Saskatchewan, just north of y'all, and showed me what it felt like to stand on a ranch that was so healthy, so alive, so vibrant, that you knew something was really good there. You knew something was really good happening. And then you find out the farmers are getting themselves out of debt by focusing on nature, and that's why I'm here. I started this thing worrying about the climate, and now I'm an advocate for farmers. I think the fact that we pay farmers so little in this country and farmers are in so much stress and debt, I think it's a crime. And the farmers that I've been filming in our series, Carbon Cowboys, they're happy people. They're working hard. They have challenges, but they're focusing on nature first, and it's a huge stress reliever for them rather than fighting nature and fighting with all the chemicals they used to use.
Well, I went online. There's a lot of information at carboncowboys.org and found out a little bit about you. You're a professor of practice at Arizona State University in both the School of Sustainability and the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications, where you teach students to make short documentary films about sustainability solutions. What got you engaged in sustainability solutions, that whole field? That's a very specific area.
It is, in a way, and then you think about it, and it's how do we make the planet better, so it's quite broad. All the films I've made since I was in film school, getting into film school, have always had something about the environment in them. The first feature documentary I made was called Garbage, and then the second feature documentary I made was Carbon Nation, which was a climate change solutions movie that doesn't even care if you believe in climate change. And the reason we called it that was because there was a lot of really smart people like my Uncle Phil and other people who were confused or not buying the arguments for climate change, but they still would understand an argument for using less energy, for being energy efficient, for having national security being a priority. And if we don't need to be buying oil from the Middle East, that's a national security issue. So that's how I started focusing in on it. And then when I found out about soils and I found out about what we're calling adaptive multi-paddock grazing, it was so powerful and it was so so engaging with the farmers and the ability to draw down so much carbon from the atmosphere and then have it do so much good on the land. That's been my focus now since 2012, and I'm not bored. I'm very engaged. I want every farmer in the United States to be focused on their soil health, and I want every farmer in the United States, I want the metric they use to be profit per acre, not bushels per acre or pounds per acre, but profit per acre. And I think if you focus on nature and you focus on profit per acre, the farmers I know, they're doing really well.
Peter Bick is a filmmaker. He's also a professor of practice at the Arizona State University. We're talking about Carbon Cowboys. This is a documentary series of short films shot over 6 years in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. And you talk about carbon mitigation and various ways to do that. I saw some fascinating examples when I sampled one of these short pieces. What would you describe as the principal and most efficient and effective ways to mitigate carbon use as you explore it in Carbon Cowboys?
Well, the reason we're focused on soils is because I think that that's a great solution for bringing down carbon from the atmosphere. We're, you know, at a certain level, carbon in the atmosphere is keeping us all alive, but we've exceeded that level. We've nearly doubled it. And a lot of the carbon in the atmosphere, maybe up to a fifth of it, is actually from our soils, from over plowing. And all of a sudden that soil, the carbon in the soil is airborne, binds with oxygen, becomes CO2, and it goes on up and warms the atmosphere for a long time, 100 years. All the carbon that Elvis ever emitted when he was a truck driver before he became famous, all that carbon's still up in the atmosphere. Uh-huh. And so when you have photosynthesis happening, that's drawing the carbon back down. And what's happening with these farmers and ranchers is they're emulating the way bison moved across the Great Plains. The herds were always densely packed, and the animals would only eat about half the forage that was available, and then they would move on, just like we only eat about half the asparagus that's put on our plate, and then we move on. And then, obviously, wolves, you know, taking off the stragglers on the outside of the herd, that would move them on as well. And then what happens, so you'd have this herd with a lot of manure evenly spread, a lot of urine evenly spread, because they're so well packed. They're eating all the plants, not just the bits and bobs that they want. And they eat half of it, they stomp the rest down, and then they move on. So what happens after they move on? The plants then go into photosynthetic overdrive, right? Because they want to grow again. So they're drawing down carbon at an enormous rate. The soil is covered because they've stomped the rest of that forage down, given the soil a nice cover so it stays cool and moist so it doesn't lose any water. And all those microbes down in the soil, they're just eating up all that carbon that the plants are shooting down there. You know, the plants take CO2 out of the atmosphere. They slough off the O2. They don't need oxygen. We do. And then they take that carbon, they mix it with water, and they create a bunch of sugars. And those sugars then become the groceries for all the soil microbial life. In a healthy prairie and on a lot of these farms, they have a lot of different plants growing, right? You want that biodiversity of plant life. And so when you have a biodiversity of plant life above ground, you have a super biodiversity of microbial life below ground. And so that whole community is working together. Some microbes are drilling into rocks, the fungi, and getting nutrients out of those rocks that the plant could never get. They're getting other micronutrients from other places, the bacteria. And so the plant is feeding the soil life below ground with all that carbon from the atmosphere. And then the soil life is feeding the plants all those nutrients. And so it's a great symbiotic system that makes the plants that much more productive, that much more nutrient dense. So, you know, in 30, 60, 90 days when the cows are coming back to graze again on the farms that I'm studying, because they let them rest for that period of time, they've got an amazing amount of forage and amazingly nutrient dense forage. So these farmers are able to raise on the same land with the same rainfall 2, 3, 4 times as many animals as they were before. And that's money. And they're able to graze that land 10 or 11 months out of the year. Therefore, they don't need hay for 3 or 4 months. And that's big money. And they're not growing their own hay and fertilizing their fields and taking all that time because they're producing enough forage on their land to feed their animals, where they might just bring in hay for December or maybe bring in hay for January. And Gabe Brown in Bismarck, he grazes all year long. I'm sure he has some hay in the winter, but they're out there grazing. I know a lot of folks who say that their animals, when they're out in the, you know, in the cold and in the snow even, that they would prefer to go graze and dig through the snow to get to the grasses out there than to eat the hay during the wintertime. So it's an amazing system of using nature to allow these farmers to lower their operating costs and increase their profits.
We spoke to Gabe Brown, a North Dakota farmer in the Bismarck area, and he's a regenerative no-till pioneer, last November. And he talked about a pilot project which will span 50,000 acres of farmland from Kansas to Canada with a group of 45 farmers. So that's a project that's underway. I guess we'll see what it turns up.
Yep.
But in your documentaries, you talk about this synthesis, and you've just referenced it a bit, art and science and history, the way the bison herds would roam around and just find what looked good.
Yep.
And so that instead of farmers planting alfalfa or some sort of feed crop, They literally let whatever nature's abundance would turn up, and the animals are put into these sort of quickly set up paddocks, grazing paddocks, and eat a variety of stuff that we used to call weeds.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of nutrients in those weeds and a lot of protein in those weeds. And as Alan Williams says in our first one of these short films, Soil Carbon Cowboys, if it's forage, then it's not a weed. And so it's all about variety. The animals, there's a great professor out of Utah State. I think he's since fully retired. His name's Fred Provenza. He's got this great research that shows that if you give a grazing animal the choices that a prairie would naturally have, they will know when to eat what kind of food to balance out their own diet, you know, so that they can balance out their own diet. And so if you just give an animal one or two or three types of food to eat, then they're not getting the biodiversity that they need to actually be balancing out their own diet and their own gut microbiome. You know, we all have a gut microbiome that's very interesting how it matches up sometimes with the soil microbiome. And how are these systems talking to each other? I think we're just scratching the surface on that. But if you look at a prairie, I mean, what is there, 100 different types of plants, 50 different types of plants? And so what's happening on the farms and ranches that we're filming is they're letting as many different types of forage grow, and then they're planting other stuff. They're playing with cocktail mixes of different types of plants to see what works for what system and what works for what animals. And, you know, if they've got compacted soil, then they're planting these radishes that poke through that hard compacted soil and let water go into there. And it's a big experiment right now. And the farmers and ranchers, they're loving the creativity that they get to play with. It's not a recipe card type of farming. And they all say, this is what's really interesting, is people think, well, you're going to take all those animals, you're going to put up an electric fence, and you're going to move them three or four times a day during the growing season, as a lot of these farmers do. That must be more work. I don't have enough people working for me, on and on. But what all these farmers say is that it's actually either the same amount of work, just different. You're not on your tractor and you're not baling hay, but you're out with your animals, or it's just a lot less work. And that's what I hear all the time from the farmers that we've been working with, that it's a lot less work. And a lot of people don't understand that, but I would just highly recommend, go visit a farmer near you who's doing this type of grazing, and just get on their land and feel how squishy the soil is, see all the bugs, understand that the birds are choosing that land to breed their babies, and smell it, and smell the soil, dig into the soil and see. Because the answers are all right there.
CarbonCowboys.org is the website with a lot of this information as well. And Peter, you mentioned how quickly and creatively some of these people that you focus on for these short documentaries have adapted their lives and their ways of doing the ranching. Well, the fellow in Saskatchewan, I can't remember his name, but
Neil Dennis.
He's laying out a quarter mile of enclosed paddock in 18 minutes or something like that. And to watch him do it is pretty amazing.
It's very easy to do. Actually, I'll just small correction. That's a quarter acre is what he's laying out there. And he's putting 850 head into that quarter acre for 2 hours.
That's intense.
And then he's opening up another quarter acre for the next 2 hours, and the animals, these quarter acres, he builds a bunch of them in a row for the day, and he has a battery latch that opens them automatically every 2 hours, and the animals naturally go into the new paddock each time that battery latch opens. They don't have to be, he's not sitting there telling them what to do, he's not calling them, they just do it because they know the forage is better. And then he has this water tank that it's portable. So he didn't even have to wire, you know, put a bunch of pipes throughout his ranch, which a lot of people do. He just has this water truck that he fills once a year with a tank full of diesel fuel, and he takes this water trough and he puts it on the edge of all of those paddocks so the animals can walk back to the water anytime they want, and then they can go eat new fresh produce anytime they want. And he's like sitting at home watching Oprah.
while that's happening.
Yeah, he had a great line there. He said if he'd started this earlier, he might have 15 kids because he'd have so much time on his hands.
I know. So
is this catching on, regenerative grazing?
It is. It's still small in the scheme of things. It's still about 2% of American farmers, but it's catching on. So Alan Williams and Gabe Brown, two of the farmers in our first film that Neil Dennis is in, they've started a group called the Soil Health Academy, and they run workshops. Alan is on the road probably 250 days of the year teaching. And when we started making the films back in 2013, they would have 50 people, maybe. And they'd have field days that have that had more people, but a lot of these workshops, about 50, 75 people. Now the workshops are much larger, and the field days are much larger, and they're all selling out, and they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I think we need many, many more folks like Gabe and Alan and their partner Ray Archuleta and all the people. So they're now teaching the teachers, right? So it's about scale, right? It's about teaching as many people to learn these things, and then they teach people. And so the way I see what I can do in this ecosystem is that I can tell these stories and I can make these films, because Carbon Cowboys, the series that's up right now, it's 10 short films from 10 very different ecosystems. You know, there's this thing that I call the yeah, but syndrome. You know, it'll work in Alabama, but it won't work in Mississippi. Or it'll work on your farm, but it won't work on mine, when there's just a fence between the two farms. I've heard that said. And the point is that these principles work from the Sonoran Desert to Mississippi to Saskatchewan to California, Kentucky. They just work. You just go and you see it happening. And so now it's a question of what Alan likes to say when he does one of his workshops. He says, you can't say it won't work where you live, but you can always ask, how do I get this to work where I live? And if our films can help that dialogue go and get folks curious and see how we can help people learn that we want them to be more productive. We want their land to be more productive. We know every farmer cares about their land. That's a no-brainer. And so what if these new methods, which are kind of based on old methods with some new applications, what if they make your land that much better and make your life that much better? Well, for me, as an American citizen who thinks that food security is about the most important national security issue we have, I want to get this message to as many farmers as possible, because I want the farmers to be prosperous.
Well, you mentioned Alan Williams. He's a PhD, and he farms around Starkville, Mississippi, where they have more than 45 inches of annual rainfall compared with the semi-arid areas of North Dakota and Saskatchewan that you were previewing with the other farmers.
Yeah, so, there's a big difference there, right?
Huge difference. And I remember Gabe Brown was saying that on his land that was around Bismarck, if he got a half-inch rainfall at one point, that was all that they could handle. Otherwise, it would pool. Now he says he can get 8 inches in an hour and accommodate it. So apparently that soil that he's been working on for a while now has become more efficient at doing what he wants to do.
Yeah, well, when you focus on soil health, a healthy soil is a very vibrant community of a lot of microorganisms. And a lot of those plants, when they get eaten at the top, they're sort of mirror image of the roots down below. That sort of dies off. And so healthy soils are this buildup of old dead roots and old dead microbes, and they're not compacted. And so they become like a sponge. And so as a sponge would be, they would soak up a lot more water in a rainfall event, where it's inches in an hour that they can absorb. And that's what they call effective rainfall. Like, it might rain an inch on your property, but did you soak it all up, or did it wash off? And when it washed off, did it wash off your topsoil with it? Because you can lose tons of topsoil in one big rain event if your soil is not covered, right? If you've just plowed and you've just planted, you've got, you know, it's a dangerous situation there for you. But if you have your soils covered, then they're not going to, the water's going to stay in there in the summer when it gets dry. It's going to be cooler. That it's like a 40 degree temperature difference between exposed soil in the summer and covered soil in the summer. It's an astounding temperature difference. Even in North Dakota, I've seen the measurements there, and when you have that healthy soil, it actually makes your farm a lot more resilient in drought as well, because it's holding on to that water longer, and because you have their soil covered, it's holding on to that water longer. But you know, where you all are, you guys have winter, right? And Neil Dennis up in Saskatchewan, he was seeing that his forage was growing a good 3 weeks longer into the fall than his neighbors, because his soil microbial life was that much more robust and still creating heat, creating life. And that in the spring, he was seeing his forage start to grow a good 3 weeks long earlier than his neighbors and than his used to, because his microbial life was coming to life and was actually starting to heat things up. So he was getting about 6 weeks more growing season in a short growing season up north than his neighbor. And again, that's just money. That's just money in the bank.
Your carbon cowboys talk about the cost effectiveness of their operations. Are schools of agriculture and state departments of ag getting behind this?
I think that's been slow. There are definitely people within the USDA and the NRCS that understand this. One specific fellow is Doug Peterson, who we film in one of our short films. It's called I Sell Water and Sunshine. He's out of Missouri. So he's been talking about this for decades. And then there's a guy up in Bismarck. I think he's retired. His name is Jay Fuhrer. Man, what an amazing man, amazingly smart human being. I had a conversation with him, about 6 months ago, and I learned so much in that one conversation with him. So these are folks from the USDA. There's a guy named Greg Brann in Tennessee. He's been talking about soil health and how do you maximize your soil health for a long time. I don't know if it's a majority of people in the USDA yet, but I know it's growing. And I know there's really smart people there that understand that our soils are in really dangerous condition as a whole across the country, and not just the United States, but across the world. But, you know, if we don't get those soils back into good shape, we don't have food security. And that is, like I said earlier, to me, one of the most important ingredients of national security is being able to feed yourself. Let's feed ourselves. Let's help feed the world sometimes. But let's take care of our farms and our communities, and we'll go from there.
Carbon Cowboys is the series of short films that create a documentary shot over 6 years in the U.S., Canada, and the United Kingdom. Peter Bick is the filmmaker. And what's your next project, Peter?
Well, what a lot of people have been asking is, are these farms actually drawing down carbon at a scale that would slow down climate change? And then the question quickly becomes, what about the methane and what about the nitrous oxide? And so we at ASU and a lot of other universities have put together a large research project that is going to answer these questions. We're going to compare the adaptive regenerative grazing on one side of the fence with conventional farmer grazer on the other side of the fence. And we're going to measure all of these metrics, soil carbon, water infiltration, breeding bird populations, bugs above and below ground, greenhouse gas cycling, microbial life, animal well-being, farmer well-being. And so this is a large research project that we've got going right now. McDonald's is our biggest funder. And so we're now making a movie as well about that research. It's on 10 farms in the Southeast U.S., and so we're working on getting the data analyzed. We started in the field in 2018, so we're in our third year now, and my editors are working really hard to edit the footage. So that's the next project. We don't know the name of it, but at our carboncowboys.org website, the information will be there when we have this project going, when we start having articles published in scientific journals, and when our film starts coming out, it'll all be there.
Peter Bick is the founder and president of Carbon Nation, an environmental film nonprofit, and he's also a professor of practice at Arizona State University in both the School of Sustainability and the School of Journalism and Mass Communications. Peter, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Coming up on Main Street, StoryCorps Connect and new technology to gather interviews during a pandemic. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Effective immediately, Sanford Health is relaxing visitation at its hospitals. Sanford Fargo Vice President and Chief Medical Officer Dr. Doug Griffin.
We are allowing one visitor per patient during visiting hours of 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily for all areas except our designated COVID-19 units. Patients are allowed to bring one visitor with them for clinic or outpatient appointments as well. They will be screened for any signs of illness, and they will be asked to bring a mask. If not bringing a mask, they'll be provided one.
Sanford's long-term facilities will remain temporarily closed to visitors. Sanford had not allowed visitors into its hospital since March 27th. There were some exceptions, including one predetermined daily visitor for births and end-of-life cases. Despite all the success of a quickly implemented distance learning program, Grand Forks school officials admit it's not necessarily a good fit for all students. North Dakota K-12 students have been out of their classrooms since mid-March because of the coronavirus pandemic. The Grand Forks School District launched the distance learning protocol on April 1st. Superintendent Terry Brenner says while some students are doing very well, it doesn't replace face-to-face learning. Brenner says they will likely have to use the first part of the 2020 and 21 year playing a little catch-up.
Some of their regular courses with homework, it's been a struggle for a lot of kids. Part of our reentry plan, when we do get back to face-to-face, there's going to be a review period, no doubt. For most of our students.
Brenner says they could get some direction about the future of fall sports from the North Dakota High School League later this week. And with people driving less, demand for fuel has plummeted, and dozens of ethanol plants across the country are sitting idle. As Congress works on another pandemic relief package, some senators want to ensure that ethanol doesn't get left out. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer has more.
Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley had proposed an amendment to the CARES Act. It would have provided relief to ethanol companies if oil companies got help. Both were left out of that law. Then the federal government bought up 1 million barrels of oil. So Grassley is introducing the amendment as a standalone bill. It's a fairness issue, he says.
I'm not sure the oil companies or oil interest senators see the same equity connection I do, but that doesn't keep us from moving ahead.
Minnesota Democrat Amy Klobuchar is co-sponsoring the bill. The House has already passed the HEROES Act, a fourth round of relief money. The Senate is working on its version. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Pork processing fell nearly 40% following temporary closures at meatpacking plants across the Midwest last month. That created a backlog of market-ready hogs. But Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports that's not causing the problems some feared.
Many observers have tried to calculate how many pigs might be euthanized during processing slowdowns. The numbers seem staggering, perhaps 1 million in a month. But after weeks of closures and some reopenings, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Negg says Iowa's tally is nowhere near that level.
We have less than 5,000 head of market-ready hogs that have been euthanized and disposed of in the state of Iowa.
It's more than anybody wants to lose, but Iowa produces about a third of all the pork, and several of the plant closures have been here or in neighboring states. Negg cautions the numbers could still go up, but with pressure to keep plants running, the worst-case scenarios may have been avoided. Still, the situation weighs on pork producers, like Greg Hora of Fort Dodge, Iowa.
This is a concern that we do not want to put down pigs. We do not want to euthanize or take food out of the food supply chain.
For now, timing is on Hora's side. He'd just taken a barn's worth of hogs to market in February. His current batch won't be full grown for a while. For those who aren't as lucky, a bipartisan group of mostly Midwest senators is urging congressional leaders to provide additional money for producers who have to dispose of hogs. But in some ways, the pork industry was prepared for a situation like this. Long before the novel coronavirus began infecting humans, they were deep into pandemic preparations. Their boogeyman? African swine fever. If that foreign animal disease got to North America, farmers would potentially have to euthanize and dispose of all their hogs on site. Iowa State University Agriculture and Biosystems Engineering Professor Daniel Anderson says the current situation strips away one important factor.
With foreign animal diseases, we're very concerned about the movement of pathogens from dead carcasses that we were known to be infected into places in the environment and then persistence of those in the environment.
Without the fear of spreading infection, a farmer who has to euthanize and dispose of animals today has more options. Composting, deep burial, shallow burial, even rendering. More than 275 people logged into a webinar last month with researchers who detailed these options. Anderson says the major unanswered question is the potential volume.
How do we handle things that happen at a larger scale all at one facility, and how do we manage that in an environmentally sound way?
The Iowa Pork Producers Association is doing what it can to prevent large-scale disposal. Working with the state and other partners, it started the Pass the Pork program to allow farmers to donate hogs for processing at local meat lockers. Iowa Pork's Joyce Hoppus recognizes the farmers still lose money.
But it helps them know that they're helping others, and hopefully we will help some of those people who are having some challenging times.
The ground pork goes to area food banks. Hoppus says the program is counting on financial donations to defray the costs of transportation and processing. But another hurdle is finding room at the state-certified meat lockers.
We have found out that most of our lockers are very, very busy right now, too.
Thank you for calling the Story City Locker. Because of the high level of demand, we are not taking calls at this time.
A message left at this and another locker went unreturned. A third declined to be interviewed, but confirmed business is brisk. Secretary Negg says the state has tried to make it easy for lockers to join Pass the Pork. For example, providing inspection services and waiving some fees. And he's looking forward to when the pandemic is over. And he can start asking questions about the gaps and the pinch points in the whole food supply chain.
I do think that we need to take a hard look at meat processing and how plants operate and how they're designed. I think those will all be things that we'll want to look at.
He says expanding small local processing options will be part of that discussion. Meanwhile, pressure is mounting on the federal government to investigate whether the big meat companies, which operate most of the idled plants, have engaged in unfair business practices. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative focusing on America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, StoryCorps Connect.
We are all trying to stay connected, whether it's for work.
It has been really amazing to see how much people are getting done without having to meet face-to-face. I'm sure there will be...
Or for less official business.
We figured out rules for virtual beer pong.
The easiest way to stay connected is a way that's always been there for you. Morning Edition from NPR News, every weekday.
Morning Edition, weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central, 3 Mountain on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Tim Wollenzien. He is the Prairie Public Education Services Manager. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And we're here to talk about StoryCorps Connect, which is something that's kind of a new wrinkle in the StoryCorps story. It's a wonderful nonprofit effort to preserve and share stories, interviews, person-to-person, families, strangers even, but hear the voices of people talking about, you know, things that affect their lives currently, and then these things are saved. And at the Library of Congress, of all places, all these, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of stories, and they'll be listened to, you know, far into the future, forever.
That's
right.
It's
kind of a cool idea.
It's a really cool idea, and StoryCorps has been around for a while. You know, people have probably heard of the bus that goes around the country and it sets up in a place for a few days and people come in and have in-person interviews there where they do the recording right in the bus. But since we've been social distancing the last couple of months, the creative folks at StoryCorps have put together this new program, StoryCorps Connect, and they've set up a platform and made it real easy for people to do interviews on their home computers or devices, and then send them in themselves, and they get archived in the same way as they always have.
Well, I went up to their website. It's a fantastic place. It's StoryCorps.org, and you can listen to any story you want. You just type in a name or a place, and I typed in Fargo and Bismarck, for example, because that StoryCorps bus has been in both these communities.
Mm-hmm.
And looked at the names that rained down and sampled some of the voices and the stories. It's a fantastic piece of oral history.
It is. Yeah, it's really neat.
So what is its educational value? Because that's your link to this story.
Well, the educational value here is that this is a time in our lives and in everyone's lives that is historic. And I think that, you know, we'll remember what happened during these times of isolation and social distancing and everything. And how maybe our lives have been affected by that, and certainly everyone's probably has. But most importantly, I think here is what they're trying to get at with this particular initiative for educators and for students, for high school students, middle and high school students, is to talk about how this has affected their lives. Students are people too, and they are missing their friends just like all of us are. They're missing their usual routines and those rites of passage that take place during those critical growing up years, particularly around graduations and proms and all those life moments that people look forward to. And so they've put together this toolkit, this initiative to invite teachers to share this with students. Or for students and families just to go and do it on their own.
Well, it's easy to do. I mean, they walk you through it, and you can sign in if you want to. You can register if you want to, or just learn about how it's done. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking about, you just referenced what a social experience school is. It work is, too, after all.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience we're living through, imagine if there had been recordings. There were movies, but not recordings of people's voices talking during the Spanish flu epidemic 100 years ago.
Right.
How we'd be listening to that now.
Right. Yes. Yes. And that's really a neat thing that, you know, we can preserve this now. We have the technology and the you know, advanced kind of storage, you know, capabilities that we can keep track of all this stuff.
So how can Prairie Public listeners take part? Walk them through that.
Go to the website, storycorps.org, and you can connect and you can download all of these resources that are there for, you know, community resources. There's the teacher toolkit, as I referenced. There's even a list of great questions that you can use to get started in case you can't really think of what to say. And it walks you through step by step the process that you would go through to set up the interview and to make sure that both you and your subject are prepared and to kind of give you a little bit of a guide to doing an interview like this. And for the StoryCorps Connect piece that has to do with educators, educators are winding down the school year now for the most part if they've not already finished. And there are here lesson plans, and there are teacher guides that teachers could use if they want to now, or hang on to this for later. This is not going to go away, this teacher StoryCorps Connect, and teachers are going to be able to use it whenever, and it's something that's always going to be there. So I guess what I'm hoping that we can do here is to share this information with our audience and to help folks guide themselves to this place where they can preserve a little bit of their lives.
Well, David Isay is the person who sort of founded the StoryCorps idea, and I just sampled a TED Talk he gave in Vancouver, British Columbia, back in 2015, and he was telling the audience why this process. He stumbled across it personally. He said he was 22 years old. He was just getting into the radio production business. And he sat down with his father, whom he adored, to have just a one-on-one interview to kind of practice his skills. And in the course of this conversation, discovered that his father was gay.
Hmm.
So the revelatory possibilities here are pretty stunning. But I'm thinking about this as, what a valuable piece of family history this is. We have photographs, But how many voices do we have that we can listen to, you know, a decade or, you know, 50 years from now?
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. You know, that one-on-one, face-to-face with a microphone is very powerful. And it really does give us an insight into people that we know and love. And you're right. There's just a wealth of possibility here with taking the time to do this. And yeah, there isn't an archive of voice, you know, between two regular people that you can access anywhere else but through this.
Well, 100 years from now, for example, if I go about doing this, and I am going to do this, my descendants could listen to me talk about life in 2020.
Yeah.
And about the people I knew. I treasure a recording of my grandmother that was made in 1975 by a cousin of mine, where she describes her childhood in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, before the turn of the 20th century.
Wow.
Walking through a forest to what was Detroit Lake.
Mm-hmm.
So these are just family treasures, literally, and they're very important to the family.
Yeah, they're very powerful.
And these interviews are, again, held by the Library of Congress, which means they're going to be around for a long time, and they're easy to access. Mm-hmm. If you go to that StoryCorps.org website, you can click on Listen, and there are all these stories up there, and they're fascinating, just to sample. Are you going to do it?
I am going to do it. Yeah. Yeah, the more I read about this and the more I listen to StoryCorps interviews, you know, the more I think, why haven't I done this? We all should do it.
And have you decided who you're going to do it with or how many you're going to do? Because I'm thinking, the list is endless almost.
No, I haven't, but I think it would be probably the people closest to me, you know, my parents, you know, siblings, spouse, children, you know, those are all of those possibilities. No, I haven't really given it a lot of thought, but certainly I think, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is you would interview elders, right? Because they have the longest memory and, you know, they have the most life events that have taken place and you know, they would have, you would think, more stories to share. So I guess that would be probably where I would start. But, you know, I think you can do it in any way. You could interview a favorite teacher or you could interview, you know, somebody who's really important in your life that may not be a relative.
Well, I'm thinking about it's kind of a busman's holiday for me because I've been interviewing people for about 50 years. But I could kick myself because my mother and father, who had wonderful memories – and lots to talk about, and were very interesting people, they're both gone.
Mm-hmm.
And none of my brothers or I ever sat down with them and actually did this kind of in-depth interview about what was it like growing up in Obion, Tennessee, or Detroit Lakes, Minnesota? How did you meet during World War II? My dad wrote about these things, which is invaluable to us, obviously. But to hear them in their own voice, there's a poignancy just thinking about it that is deeply affecting.
Very much so. So send people to StoryCorps, look for StoryCorps Connect and find out how to do this yourself, to share it with others and spread the word. Let folks know that this exists and it's easy to access and it's going to be kind of fun.
It goes to the archive at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. It becomes a part of American history and perhaps even more importantly, a part of your history, your family's history. Tim, thanks for bringing this to our attention.
You bet. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tim Wollenzien is Prairie Public's Education Services Manager. Coming up on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. You know, often when I'm on the air, I'm asking you to make a contribution to Prairie Public, and I'll still be doing that since listener support is still our most important support. But right now, let me also encourage you to support the businesses and nonprofits that sponsor Prairie Public, or used to. It's a tough time for a lot of them, too, so show your support with gift cards or advance ticket purchases or other things. We appreciate them, and we want to keep them going, too. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Chuck Lura is a familiar voice to Prairie Public listeners. He's a former biology teacher and the man behind the Natural North Dakota essays heard on our network. Chuck shares his interest in the plants and animals in our part of the world, and today his topic is mink.
I looked out our window one morning recently and saw a mink along the shoreline of Lake Metegoshi. It scurried around for a few minutes before disappearing in the water near some cattails. These semi-aquatic members of the weasel family can be found over much of North America. As you may expect, they're at home near most any body of water, from marshes and lakes to creeks and rivers, where they can prey on a wide range of animals, including muskrats, rabbits, and other small mammals, waterfowl and other birds and fish. They're rather opportunistic feeders. As most everyone knows, mink are typically dark brown, with a white or perhaps yellowish chin spot, and maybe a bit more color on the throat or chest. Males are larger than females, with the males weighing around 3 pounds, while the females around 2 pounds. They're about 1.5 to 2 feet long, with the females again on the smaller side. The mink I observed looked rather small, so it was probably a female. Both males and females will have home ranges of around 3 square miles, but as you might expect, that can be quite variable depending on habitat and other factors. And although the range of males and females may overlap, members of the same sex are not welcome. Mating occurs around March in our state. Usually one litter of 2 to 7 young will be born in May, with the young staying with the female until fall. Mink are also rather opportunistic when it comes to denning sites. They may utilize an unoccupied burrow, such as that of a ground squirrel. Unoccupied muskrat huts are also commonly utilized, as are rock piles, brush piles, hollows in logs or trees, or even a culvert. As many of you know, mink have the reputation for developing a taste for domestic poultry. After all, they often taste like chicken. The stories of mink raiding hen houses is legendary. Art Bailey, in his A Biological Survey of North Dakota from 1926, wrote about one report that came from Willows, North Dakota in 1886. In one night, a mink killed all but one chicken on a farm. The mink returned the next night and tried to get at the carcasses that the farmer had placed up on the house. The mink promptly returned a third night and killed the last rooster. So if you're around bodies of water this summer, be on the lookout for this interesting mammal. And if you're raising chickens, make sure they're secured in a mink-proof structure at night. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Hi, I'm Tom Brousseau. I want to thank everyone who listened to the debut episode of The Great American Folk Show. You know, we received a lot of nice comments from a lot of people about the program. It kind of seems like we struck the right chord. Did you miss the premiere? Well, you can stream it anytime, on demand, at prairiepublic.org. But let's look ahead now to the next show. Sunday, June 7th at 5 p.m. Central, with another side of punk legend John Doe of the band X.
All he ever wanted was a little patch of sunlight.
And you might know them as two-thirds of Grammy-winning bluegrass stars Nickel Creek, Sarah Watkins, and Sean Watkins on the show.
Sometimes you gotta break down.
Plus, New York Times best-selling author Daniel Levitin, North Dakota poet Madeline Kamrud, and Los Angeles writer Julie Wolfson on the joys of gefilte fish, and lots more. I would be honored if you'd listen and enjoy The Great American Folk Show on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 20th. In early April 1971, two strange metal balls were found in southeastern North Dakota. Both weighed about 20 pounds with faded stripes. They were very hot and about 15 inches in diameter. One, found by Corwin Brumond, had a hole 5 inches in diameter, and the other, found east of Oaks by Mike Michel, had a hole 6 inches in diameter. It was later learned that two others had been found, one near Ingevale and one near Litchville. These North Dakota oddities aren't unique. There have been quite a few of these mysterious spheres, or space balls, found in the United States and around the world. So, what are these strange things? While some people were inclined to suspect alien UFO technology, the balls are actually a special kind of space debris that held helium as part of a spacecraft's propulsion system. On this date, in 1971, the Oaks Times reported the explanation. According to Oaks native Irving Tiedon, a space project manager in Huntsville, Alabama, the mysterious balls had fallen from a U.S. experimental satellite, the Agena spacecraft. The Agena was a multi-purpose docking vehicle used in the Gemini program. Made of titanium, the balls are able to survive the re-entry from orbit. Similar balls from spacecraft of other countries have also been found. In addition to space balls, larger steel propellant tanks and pieces of thermal blankets are also known to make it back to Earth. So, what are your chances of being hit by space debris? One estimate suggests there's a 1 in 3,200 chance of someone getting hit, but the chance of any given individual being hit is 1 in several trillion. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Tessa Sandstrom. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Anxiety and depression magnify the impact of the pandemic for children.
It's harder for me to find joy in little moments.
Therapists say parents can help.
We are going to have to create, as parents, structures that usually other people do.
Managing kids' mental health needs on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Main Street, and we remind you that as we broadcast, we also stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can always find a Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. On our show tomorrow, we'll feature an excerpt from Conversations on Healthcare. Hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter will talk with Dr. John Halamka, president of the Mayo Clinic Platform, which seeks to improve healthcare through better data. Tom Eason will have a Plains Folk essay titled Good Shepherds. Eliza Blue will offer another postcard from the prairie, and Sue Balcom will drop by for Main Street Eats. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.